cutting through an overload of information to get to the heart of the story. This is The Point.
Welcome to The Point, an opinion show coming to you from Beijing. I'm Li Xin. China's economic prospects go from bad to worse. China is uninvestable. China faces critical moment in push to revive economy. Blah, blah, blah. Some media are struggling with words to paint a bleak picture of China's economy, but China saw a GDP growth of 5.2% last year, hitting the government's own target. Despite China getting a passing grade, there are indeed challenges that China is faced with. For example, the real estate sector downturn and fluctuating foreign investments. How to evaluate China's growth last year? How to make sense of the seemingly contradicting figures? I was joined from Beijing by Yao Yang, liberal arts chair professor at Peking University. Professor Yao, welcome to The Point. It's good to have you back on the show, and it's such a coincidence that last year, almost exactly at the same time, you were on my show and you were predicting the growth of the Chinese economy. You were, however, quite optimistic. You said that the Chinese economy for the year 2023 should be able to grow at least 6%, if not 8%, but we know the final number for last year was 5.2%. Were you too optimistic? What changed during the year?
The interesting, you still remember that. That's good, right? Often the case, when you can't say something, then people tend to forget what they said, you know, before. So that's good. Yes, in a sense, we all made a mistake at the beginning of last year. I think one of the reasons was that the Chinese economy bounced back so strongly at the beginning of last year. And the people were optimistic about government policy. And I think we missed the part, very important part, I think, thinking back, that the Chinese government has many objectives, not just one single, say, economic growth, right? I think in the past several years, the Chinese economy has been on a transition path, and the government put more weights on other objectives, particularly to deliver the economy, to regulate the real estate sector, all sorts of things, right? But having said that, I would say 5.2% growth, which already a very respectable growth rate anyway.
You said that right now China is transitioning from a previous growth model to a newer growth model, namely from one focusing on quantity to one focusing on quality. What kind of pressure, what kind of stress is that placing on the Chinese economic performance? Is that going to play out over the coming period of time? Do we have to be more realistic about growth targets over the next 5 years, let's say?
I still believe, or my calculation shows, China still has a potential growth rate, at least 5.5%. That was also one of the reasons I give like 6%, right? So the Chinese economy itself has no problem. Many foreign observers say, you know, the Chinese growth is meeting its end. China is not going to catch up with the United States in terms of the size of the economy. I don't think so. China's economy still has a huge amount of potentials. What we have been seeing in the last several years is the consequence of the government's deliberate adjustments. Why the government is doing this? You know, China's government, in a sense, is always ahead of time. You know, China has this five-year plans, right? So it just think in the future, you know, the Chinese economy could move from a purely investment-driven growth model to a more innovation-based, consumption-driven economy, right? But the transition, I have to say, can be really painful, right? Probably that also explains why the growth rates in the last several years have not met our expectations. But with all the transition finished, the Chinese economy is going to become healthier and produce higher quality growth.
Give us some examples when you say the fundamentals of the Chinese economy are good. Can you give us some concrete barometers or indices to substantiate your argument? Yeah.
Well, there are actually many. Let me just deal with one example, a very significant one, AI. People say, hey, how can you talk about the AI? United States, of course, is the leader of AI, right? Recently, Soros just makes so much attention in China. Admitted that the United States is still the leader of the high-tech sector. But in terms of the application, in terms of the real application in the economy, China is doing the best. Many people don't know actually to test whether you can use AI to boost your productivity. One good testing ground is the EV industry. In the past, EV companies compete with batteries. Now they're going to compete with driverless driving. Okay. And China has a huge capacity in this area, particularly when Huawei joins. The whole industry is going to change. And so in the middle level in the technology, China is replacing advanced countries.
However, if you read the press stories, whether international press and some domestic press, there are talks of a lack of confidence. Am I right to say that for the second half of last year, for instance, the lack of confidence, for whatever reason, also contributed to the lower growth of the economy or slower consumption rate?
Well, probably the causality was just reversed, right? It was because the growth didn't meet the expectation, so people's expectation became worse. Last year, 5.2% was a respectable growth rate. I think the reason people's expectation was low were twofold. First, some industries actually grew really fast. Okay. So if you go to, say, the EV industry, IT industry, you see huge boost, right? But then if you go to other sectors, like the housing sector, it's still being declining even today, right? So that's one of the reasons. Another reason was the recovery didn't meet the people's expectation, like me, right? So in the beginning, we all expected like a 6% or even higher growth rate. But it didn't happen. Right? So then people say, it doesn't meet my expectation, so my expectation should be lower.
Does that explain the increasing amount of savings by Chinese residents when they are not confident that life is going to get better in the very near period of time, that they're saving more, but they have money, they're just holding back the consumption?
Yeah, to some extent that's true, but we also need to notice last year consumption grew quite remarkably. Some people I remember put the growth rate of consumption at 9%. But anyway, if you look at the composition of growth last year, consumption growth contributed more than 80% of China's total growth.
Yeah, here seems a bit of contradiction. Some people put rise of consumption at 9%. The National Bureau of Statistics put last year the total retail sales of consumer goods at 7.2%. So consumption doesn't seem weak, and yet we hear the talk of lack of confidence. Is there a contradiction there?
Yeah, I think that there is a contradiction. As I said, some sectors were so good, some sectors were bad. In most societies, bad words actually have wings. So the flag father. People always say, I haven't earned enough money. But for those people who have earned enough money, they don't talk, right? So pessimistic move follows a much farther than good news, okay? I think that explains a lot. We shouldn't put too much emphasis on consumption. This consumption is already growing quite respectably. We should put more emphasis on investment. Last year, investment didn't meet our expectation.
When you say investment didn't meet your expectation, what exactly do you mean? Because one story that was viral on international media headlines, mainstream media especially, was that foreign direct investment to China collapsed, and they were basing their observation on numbers released by the competent Chinese authority in terms, you know, who are calculating the so-called direct investment liabilities for, they say, for the first time in 30 years, China's foreign direct investment performs so badly. And yet there are other people who are pointing to other figures which do not show the kind of fluctuation. Exactly, how important is the fluctuation of foreign direct investment to the Chinese economy?
The short answer is that we're small because foreign direct investment accounts for we're a small portion of China's total capital formation. I think now less than 2%. We're small, okay? And the significance is more on the media. You know, the story is the same. If you break up foreign direct investment, you're going to see in high-tech area, foreign direct investment is increasing, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But of course, if you look at the China as a whole, private investment also declined in the last year. So this is one thing. Another one is that you have to break up by region, right? The real drop of the FDI in China actually came from the United States. If you look at the European investment, European is increasing its investment in China. I heard one CEO of a large European company say, oh, so the government asked us to de-risk from China, but for us, de-risking means to add more investment in China because for our company, China is the only market that is still growing. You have to separate them. It's true foreign direct investment is leaving China, that's American investment. But we all know the reason. The reason is not economic. It's actually political because the United States has a sanction on China because the United States say, if you invest in China, we are going to attack on you, right? To avoid this kind of political risk, American investors stop investing to China.
Yeah, there was this recent documentary or longer piece by 60 Minutes by a mainstream U.S. media to talk about China's investment environment, and they interviewed the U.S. ambassador to China who was talking about foreign capitals fleeing China because of the worsening market. But when the journalist went and talked to individual managers of American businesses here in China, for instance, the growing number of Starbucks here in China on the mainland, or the CEO of Disney, who told the American journalist that their business in China is thriving. So why yes. There are these kind of different narratives and basically all incorporated in the same U.S. Production, in the same U.S. journalistic piece?
Yeah, actually, 60 Minutes consulted me before they came to China to shoot the documentary. I think Mr. Burns was disillusioned, right? That was wrong.
The U.S. ambassador to China.
Foreign companies are not leaving China. If it happened, and most American companies and some Japanese companies, I have to admit, but if you look at the European companies, European companies are adding more investment into China, right? Even among American companies, the number is really, really small. You know, we can say that our American companies stop investing more in China, but it doesn't mean that they are leaving China.
Finally, let me get to the trade number very quickly. There are some again, media reports about China trying to shape global trade to its terms and all talks of China's trade dropping, foreign trade dropping as well. China's exports did grow at 0.6% year on year last year. That's according to official numbers. So how good or how bad is that number?
That's actually in terms of RMB. In terms of US dollars, China's export declined by, I think, about 6%, okay, because of the appreciation of dollar. Okay. Mm-hmm. By international comparison, it's not that bad because the whole world trade volume declined by 5% last year. Anyway, okay, China's export is in transition. I think the session that China is reshaping its global trade is wrong. It's actually the United States political moves are actually reshaping China's export markets, right? So to respond to American sanctions and also high tariffs put on Chinese exports, Chinese companies are investing heavily in other companies, right? To some extent, it was bad for China because in the short run, Chinese companies had to make all the adjustments, and the cost of those adjustments are high. But in the long run, it's going to be good for China in the long run, because in the end, China is going to be like Japan or United States to create, one-fifth of China outside China anyway. Okay. I don't think American moves trying to decouple with China is going to succeed in the end. It's going to hurt the United States in the end. I'm confident on that.
Yao Yang, liberal arts chair professor at Peking University, many thanks. When we come back, the CIA told the world it has stepped up spying on China. What are they hoping to find? Stay tuned.
Making room for all opinions and seeing events from more than one side. This is The Point.
For your eyes only, or for the entire world to hear, U.S. Spy Chief CIA Director William Burns mentioned China at least seven times in an article published in Foreign Affairs recently, calling China's rise both a geopolitical challenge and a big long-term threat. Burns revealed that the CIA has more than doubled the percentage of its overall budget focused on China over just the last 2 years, and a China Mission Center has been set up, making China the only country with its own center under the CIA. Burns tells the world that they have stepped up hiring and training Mandarin-speaking spies while stepping up efforts across the world to compete with China. While the Biden administration has advocated a strategy to stabilize ties with China, including cooperating where they can, is this strategy going to work in reality? What does the apparent paradox reveal? And how can China safeguard itself against what some perceive as America's Orwellian surveillance? I was pleased to be joined from Beijing by Benjamin Norton, editor-in-chief of Geopolitical Economy Report, and by Victor Gao, chair professor at Suzhou University. Mr. Gao, that is the premise of the U.S.-China strategy under the Biden administration. Is there something wrong with it?
Absolutely. I think Mr. Burns, the CIA and the U.S. government are completely misguided in how to read China. It is true that China's economic development is still pushing ahead. And I would say around 2030, the overall size of the Chinese economy measured by official exchange rate will surpass that of the United States. This is inevitable. On the other hand, China is perfectly happy just to live in peace with the United States, your God for you, my God for me, and we are not going out there to challenge whatever the United States is. However, the United States seems very eager to view China in a hostile manner and claiming that the rise of China constitutes a threat to the United States. Come on, China will continue to rise, and you have to live with that fact. Now, on the other hand, the fact that Mr. Burns reveals that the United States is doubling the size of the China operation within the CIA, allocating more funds, hiring more people, is either a bluffing or an open challenge to China. And this will only strengthen China's confidence and the resources to deal with these espionage activities launched by the United States against China.
Benjamin, you know, China is obviously getting the attention that other country would envy. I mean, a China mission center, you know, doubling the percentage of funding for the CIA, according to Mr. Burns. Does China really deserve this special treatment? And why announcing it to the world? Is it to alarm China? Obviously not. But what's the point of making it clear to the world that the U.S. is doing this and has been doing this over the past couple of years?
Well, it's clearly a threat. And if you read carefully in the article in Foreign Affairs, you can see that Burns, the CIA director, repeatedly refers to China as a so-called threat and the biggest so-called threat. Now, for me as an American, for many American people, this is ridiculous. When they say threat, what they really mean is a so-called threat to the U.S.-dominated hegemonic order. And this is quite frustrating because the U.S. government constantly claims, at least the Biden administration claims, that it does not want a new Cold War. Instead, they refer to their policy as competition. But if you read carefully what Burns and other officials have said, they're using Cold War rhetoric. In fact, in his Foreign Affairs article, Burns says that the post-Cold War era ended with the war in Ukraine in 2022, and he refers to both Russia and China as a threat. So if you read between the lines, he's essentially saying that the U.S. is waging a new Cold War. We see that the U.S. has not learned any of the lessons of the previous Cold War. It's engaged in this very aggressive kind of Cold War strategy.
Jake Sullivan actually almost simultaneously was elaborating on the implementation of the U.S. strategy, namely the confront, compete, and cooperate diagram. Confront where they should, compete where they must, and cooperation when they could. I mean, people are getting confused. But at this time, he was just talking about how the Biden administration has stabilized a relationship with the United with China over the past year, and yet you are seeing this very hostile rhetoric, you know, treating China as the largest, and they're among the same administration. Mr. Gao, do you think that reveals something about this administration? I mean, can it really work, and can China really react to this? You know, you want me to cooperate with you, but on the other hand, you're doubling down and spying on me. How is China supposed to deal with this?
Well, first of all, Washington is talking the talk, but walking a different walk. Secondly, when they talk about the three C's, they actually have only one thing in mind. That is to hold China down onto the ground as if there are no consequences. However, allow me to emphasize one point. According to a U.S. study, China's manufacturing output is more than the next nine countries combined together. Therefore, I think this containment strategy by the United States against China will eventually end up in great failure, because China is here, China will stand firm, China will develop, and eventually the United States and China need to get along with each other rather than Washington betting that they can hold China down.
Let's talk about this counter-espionage law that was very much, you know, exposed in the international mainstream media. The law that China enacted, which took effect on July the 1st last year, China says it was to strengthen national security. However, when you look at some of the Western media reports, it was used as a tool for geopolitical confrontation with the U.S. or targeting international investments or business people operating in China. Benjamin, looking back, do you think China did the right thing? I mean, are China's concern with national security actually warranted?
Absolutely. And it's not just China. Many countries around the world have implemented similar national security laws. Ironically, the U.S. has very strict national security laws, but when other countries implement similar legislation, the U.S. accuses them of being authoritarian, supposedly. And actually, the U.S. surveils countries around the world, as we've seen through the reports of whistleblowers like Edward Snowden. But back on the subject of China and national security, this shows this double standard in which the United States tries to have its cake and eat it too. The U.S. boasts publicly that it's expanding its spying on China it boasts that it's doubling its budget for CIA operations. And yet, if China responds to these public revelations by furthering increasing its security, then the U.S. says that they're supposedly being authoritarian. This is what the U.S. has done with many countries. It boasts of its ability to meddle in their internal affairs. And when those countries respond with their own sovereign policies to defend their national security, the U.S. attacks them. So once again, we see this very kind of hegemonic mentality. The political class and some of these big corporate monopolies, they want competition because they see China, its economy, as a threat to their dominance of the world. Mm-hmm. And they don't believe in cooperation. They believe in a zero-sum game mentality.
That definitely makes it more difficult for the Chinese authority to try to work with the United States for mutual benefit. China, in reaction to this report, has said that China will, as always, be vigilant and won't let the U.S. illegal practice have its way. Let's hope that China is not being hooked to overreact. But what I find interesting is, in the same article, Mr. Burns also wrote about Ukraine. He says the key to success lies in preserving Western aid for Ukraine. At less than 5% the U.S. defense budget, it is relatively modest investment with significant geopolitical returns for the United States and notable returns for American industry. Victor, how do you look at the CIA director talking about, you know, notable returns for American industry and geopolitical gains for the United States with a modest investment in Ukraine aid here?
Well, whatever return that Mr. Burns is talking about to the United States, in many respects of the word, is at the huge cost of civilian lives suffered in Ukraine. I think the only right thing is to achieve ceasefire as quickly as possible to bring this war to an end, and through peace and diplomacy to preserve the sovereignty of Ukraine as a member state of the United Nations. That's the only right thing.
Benjamin Norton, editor-in-chief of Geopolitical Economy Report, and Victor Gao from Suzhou University. With that, we come to the end of this edition of The Point with me, Li Xin. As always, you can follow me on Facebook and Twitter using the handle Li Xin in Beijing. You've got The Point.